Paul Karanikas knew Charles James through famed fashion illustrator Antonio Lopez. Over a 10-year period starting in 1964, Lopez drew every garment James ever designed. They worked closely together, and Karanikas was there with them much of the time.
They would go to the Chelsea, to his studio. He had three studios at that time, and eventually only two. And they would get a model, and Charles would dress the model the way it should be, because sometimes his clothes are hard to, it's hard to tell how they're supposed to fit. He would fix the clothing up, and then they would bring a model of their choice. They had favorite models, and they would draw them. If there was no female model available, it didn't matter, because Charles' clothes fit on everybody. It didn't even matter if you were short or tall or fat or thin. The clothing always fit in some way, and he would often just put the clothes on himself and show us the way the clothing was supposed to fit. And you could put it on, anybody could put it on, and it fit.
Lopez would then draw what was clearly a sight for the eyes.
What I remember most about them is the colors. They're just so gorgeous. The colors are like so, he had an incredible sense of color. They were not what you'd expect. You'd turn the dress, you'd turn the corner of a dress and it would be a color you would never have expected, which was kind of great.
Sumptuous colors aside, James was known for his unique patterns, which many describe as mathematical.
He had this whole theory about there were certain points in the clothes that had to be there, and they had to be precisely there in order for the draping of the cloth, of the dress or the coat or whatever it is, to fit. And it worked.
These were garments so masterfully produced, Salvador Dali even called one piece by James the first soft sculpture.
I considered him a sculptor. Nowadays, it's maybe a little bit different because people collaborate a lot and you get people to make your things. But back then, an artist had a vision and he wanted to realize it. So he was basically in the wrong profession as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, you have to collaborate with a million people when you're making clothing, including the marketers and the merchants. So that was his point of view, would be like the merchants, as he would call them, were impossible. You know, they just did not agree with him. And so then he would get very frustrated and very angry.
But that mentality did not serve James well in business.
Merchandising. Yeah. You have to know what that involves, how it's going to happen, who you're going to collaborate with, who you're going to kowtow to. You know, all those things are very important. And he just didn't have it. The state was in disarray, the state of his business. But I was aware because he let me know in no uncertain terms about all the past from the 40s, the 50s, maybe even the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And all the people he had dealt with during those times and the people he hated, including Halston and Diana Vreeland. They were like his arch enemies. He would call Halston a dressmaker and Diana Vreeland a witch.
James's temper was famous. Part of the problem was he was always right.
It was very hard for him to accept the fact that that other people thought they knew better. I remember going to the Everson Museum in Syracuse, New York, with him, and he was having his first major retrospective, and the curator of the show, I remember her name, Trop Blumberg, Mrs. Trop Blumberg, because he enunciated it in disdain to her when he saw that she had hung something in the wrong place. It was a drawing that she hung in the entrance as you came into the museum, and he felt it shouldn't be there because it was a drawing by Antonio. So he took it off the wall. It was the opening night that night, and he walked out of the museum with it. He said, "This is mine, and I'm not having it here." And we had to chase him down the street and convince him that we should take it back, and they would put it in another place. And he says, "Mrs. Trop Blumberg did it." It went back up, but not where she had put it. But yeah, it went back up. He was fine with having it where he wanted it.
There were also tender moments that Karanikas will never forget.
We had a birthday party for him. It was his last birthday at the studio, and that was kind of great. We had a great studio on 18th and Broadway, and it was 3,500 square feet of space, you know, two stories high. It's a wonderful studio. And all our models, they used to stay with us, you know, his models, rather, used to live with us. And Charles loved that, you know, he loved that atmosphere. And so he was thrilled that we had a birthday party for him. And it was a great party. You know, we had dinner and we had a birthday cake, and a lot of the models came, and you know, I think he really enjoyed himself.
Karenikas recognizes at least one aspect of today's culture that James would have appreciated.
Well, I think, you know, the gay part is very important because he was married and he had two kids. He wasn't able ever to be comfortable with that when he was young. I think later he was fine. But I think, you know, that comes with our century, or the 20th century, and the 21st even more now. He didn't live into that, but I think he would have been very happy to see that part of what became with gay rights and all that stuff that happened in America. He died just on the cusp of all that, you know. It was, I mean, Stonewall had happened, but not much after, but I think he would be very happy about that. I mean, it just wasn't, you know, that's the way it was in those days. I mean, you could be gay, but you couldn't be out.
And what does he think of James's legacy now?
He was ahead of his time in some ways. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're successful during your lifetime, if you're going to be successful forever, what's the difference? If you look at it from a point of view of the American dream, yes, it's a tragedy. He didn't become Balenciaga, but so what? He's becoming it now.